Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going.
Hey, Ben. Brian.
How are you?
Good. Is that what you mostly go by, Brian?
Yeah, I've always been called my middle name. So all my books and acting are G. Brian Benson, but yes.
Okay. What's the G?
It's Gary. I jokingly say it depends on the day of the week, but it's Gary.
Okay. Yeah. Well, cool. I wanted to initially talk to you about baseball, but you know,
yeah. Just,
I mean, I feel like there's so much I'm curious about from what you're getting into, what you've done, and just starting with I don't even know where to start.
It's all good. Baseball, I've always loved baseball. I mean, I'm sure you're the same way, right?
Well, no. So I grew up loving the Red Sox, Wade Boggs. Grew up in Pennsylvania, so like to watch the Yankees too, and Phil Rizzuto and the announcing, and then I kind of lost touch, and I went into Peace Corps, so I was out of the country for 4 years, and I just completely lost touch with all sports.
Where'd you go? I was signed up and ready to go, and my son was accidentally conceived, and so I didn't go, but I was supposed to go to Morocco for 2 years. How about you?
Oh, wow. I mean, that sounds pretty sweet. My wife really wants to go to Morocco, but I went to El Salvador. I was there. They had two major earthquakes in 2000 or 2001, and I went right afterward and was there for probably 2.5 years in Peace Corps, and then I stayed to teach at the American school. I remember my first year there, I was living in the mayor's house in my little town, and he had this old black and white television, and I was watching the World Series. It was the Yankees and the Diamondbacks, and it was like one of the greatest dramatic World Series ever. And it was raining and the roof was leaking. I was watching the game, but it was a really cool experience.
What a memory.
But, yeah. But really, then I just started to disconnect. And then for years afterward, I wasn't following any sports. And really only the last maybe 4 or 5 years, I started to get back into sports. I started reading baseball books and baseball novels and really just found it again. And, to the point where I am now. And it's really cool to have that connection back.
Oh boy. I mean, I guess I'm not exactly sure where I found the love for it. I mean, my dad was a really great athlete in a lot of different sports and stuff, but I don't know. I think I got a pack of cards, like 1974 Tops, and I was going through them and I was kind of asking him who were some of the good players. The only one I remember getting was a Brooks Robinson card, but I don't know. I would study the stats, and I would know who had the most home runs, who had the most RBIs. I mean, all that stuff I just digested and just devoured. And I'm from Oregon. We didn't have a team. And so the Mariners hadn't been created yet. And I've never been a Mariners fan. So I think one of my little league teams was the Angels. So I became an Angels fan. And then we started going to spring training a couple times. We'd drive 2,000 miles, probably 1,200 miles down to Palm Springs. They were training there before they moved to Phoenix. And there was, I think they were at the College of the Desert or somewhere, but it was like nothing compared. It's like a high school field almost. Huh. And there's chain link fence, and you know, you could lean right against them, and Nolan Ryan was right there. I mean, I'm like a foot away, you know, chatting with him as like a 9 and 10 year old. And it was just amazing, just the accessibility. And after the game, I'd walk to the dugout and I'd talk to whoever and say, do you guys have any cracked bats? And I'd get some cracked bats. I remember getting a Carney Lansford bat and a Jeff Newman bat. It was catcher for the A's. So it was just really fun and exciting. And I used to go to flea markets with my grandparents and I'd look for cards and I got a whole bunch of cards, you know, way back. When, and so that was always is a thrill of a hunt. And I don't know, it just kind of kept building. And as I initially mentioned to you, when we were emailing back and forth, I found a magazine since I started collecting cards that had a whole bunch of addresses in it. And this is in the mid 70s, the ball players that played in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so I started writing these guys, you know, in my little third grade handwriting or whatever. And I'd include an in that index card or two, or maybe if I had a card of them, I'd send it. And I started, and I kept track of like the date I sent it, and I would start getting stuff back. And it was just like Christmas at the mailbox almost every day. And I wrote to a lot of the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, Pee Wee Reese, Duke Snyder, Carl Farrillo, Don Newcomb, they all wrote back. And I remember Newcomb being the quickest. It came back in a week. Hank Aaron, his took a year.
And so you were writing letters and they were just,
I was writing letters. Little letters and including an index form is with a self-addressed stamped envelope. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like as just, I do want to come back to this, but
yeah.
You know, really seeing all that you've done in your life and all these different pursuits, all these different creative pursuits. I mean, I wonder if it's connected there. Like to be able to try, like you're just going out and trying these things and learning as a kid. If I try, people will respond, and I'm getting something back.
No, that's a thank you. That's a great observation, I don't think you're wrong. When I was younger, I had my own room was downstairs in the basement. I just loved to like litter it with baseball posters and just would decorate it and just, you know, and just go over my collections all the time and just dream. And so I think that probably is definitely a part of me. And I didn't know I had a lot of the creativity that I'm doing now until I left my family business 15 years ago into the unknown. I kind of accidentally wrote my first book and it just pointed me in a whole new direction. And I just kept following the intuitive breadcrumbs. But the fact that I wrote to all those guys in the 70s and a lot of the other stuff I just kind of did because I kind of got a whim and I felt like, let's just see what happens. The same thing kind of happened with triathlons after I injured my knee. You know, I set a goal a year later to get my knee right. And I did a short course race and I loved it and did four more that summer and did 10 the next year. And then I started, did an Ironman and just, I don't know. I was pretty good at throwing spaghetti against the wall and stepping into, you know, things that felt interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, do any of these, it's like any of these, do you still have the letters? Yes, I do.
Yeah. They're not here with me in Arizona, but yes. And what I started doing 20 years ago, you can get really order amazing photos from the Hall of Fame. And so I would order some photos of the guys that sent me back index cards and such. And so then I would have them framed. And I, you know, it's pretty cool. So I do have them all. They're in a couple of plastic tubs right now.
That's really cool though. It's like I think of all the things. I'm doing research right now for this next season, and I'm researching W.P. Kinsella, who wrote Shoeless Joe, which was turned into Field of Dreams, and he grew up, like, way outside of civilization, basically, in the middle of Canada, and no kids, like, had to entertain himself, grew up reading a lot, and then when he finally went to school, he was so far ahead of everyone else. And I don't know, I'm just connecting that to what you're talking about and these valuable lessons and what would be helpful for kids. And you know, that's not necessarily a part of the curriculum to, you know, why don't you try these things and see what happens, and oh, you might succeed, you might fail, you're going to get rejections, but man, what a lesson in terms of something valuable to learn in life.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, it really made me feel alive. And sort of those other things that I've kind of stepped into or tried. And so that for me in and of itself, I would get an initial hit like, you know, But then once I started just like waking up, it's like, all right, this is what I'm supposed to do. So, I mean, that's just like, if you can just do the things that make you feel alive, you will be sent down the right path.
Yeah. And I was into baseball cards too. Once you start getting into the statistics, like, you know, the person, and it makes everything so much more interesting to follow the game. So I imagine that's part of that too. Like, you feel like you kind of know the person. And I mean, you weren't necessarily collecting the cards of the people you're writing to, because they're from so far back, but it's still...
I was trying to. I mean, if I found old cards. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I've got a bunch of... I had a bunch of... I don't have them anymore. I had a bunch of cards from the 50s and before. And I still have an 18... I think it's 1888 or 1886 or 1888 tobacco card.
Tobacco card. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Satchel Paige was really my guy, because I wrote to him, and he sent back an index card, but he also sent a business card of his autographed. And so I just tried to learn everything I could about him. Got some of his cards, and so that was fun. And some of the other Negro League ball players responded to me, Cool Papa Bell and a few others. And so it was just really exciting. And it just kind of became a history lesson in and of itself.
It feels like, I don't know if there's a disconnect looking at you, because you look young, and then you're
58
talking
tomorrow.
58, really?
Yes.
Nice job.
Don't tell anybody. Thanks.
But it's like, okay. And then you're connecting with this generation. Like, wow. I don't know. I think there's something too, where, you know, the athlete or the baseball player, once they're retired, they're kind of gone, you know? And so it's harder to think of them as a regular person in their 40s, in their 50s, 60s, 70s, you know? And so it's like, wow, Satchel Paige. Like, I think of him barnstorming in the 20s and 30s. And like, you're connecting with him and he's writing to you in the 70s. That's crazy.
Yeah. And you know, life goes so fast. But yeah, you're right. It's fascinating. I've always been fascinated by that what you just discussed. Like, I love all kinds of U.S. history. And so, you know, I'll kind of like, somebody might have died like in the 30s or 40s, but yet they were born in 1850 or 60, and they had all this stuff happen to them that was like, you know, that we all know about and read about. But yet I was only born like 20 years after they died, or 15 years after they died, or what have you. You know, my great grandmother, who I knew until I was almost 30, she was born in 1898. And just imagine all that she went through in her life and witnessed.
Yeah. I mean,
cars, planes, war. I mean, you name it, the moon.
And you knew her, like, she was alive when you were alive.
She lived till 96. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. I think I talk about that in one of my episodes. It's like, I always find a reason to come back to this, but it's like you can go a few generations and like to get to like the early 1800s. To one of the first presidents. Like, you think of, feel like you understand, we understand humans. Yeah, a human can live to 100, but then when you put that together, it's like two humans could be like 210 years. That's incredible.
It is. It really is. Yeah. So, you know, I just between my love of baseball and history, I just dove in, and yeah, it's been fun. You know, I remember going, my dad would take me to a few Mariners games the first or second year, and like around 77 or 78. And we'd see the Angels, because we like the Angels, and we stayed at the same hotel they did. And so I ran into Nolan Ryan, come out of an elevator, you know, and got his autograph. Remember we went and saw the Red Sox, and Carlton Fisk was just sitting in the lobby. And so I went over there and I got a picture with him. He was a really nice guy. Wow. I remember seeing Jim Rice and I think Bob Montgomery, a catcher, sitting in their little cafe, and we sat at a table next to him, and I'm just kind of looking over the whole time, you know what I mean? And I asked him if I could get his autograph. He said, absolutely, but let me finish my meal first.
Uh-huh.
Fair enough.
He's got boundaries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know,
I mean,
yeah.
When do you think those, like that accessibility went away?
That's a great question. Because it's a completely different thing now. It's just so much more expensive,
yeah,
and commercial. When did that go away?
Well, you're talking still, because I don't know if there's it's still going to be a few years for the $1 million first $1 million salary. So that's
I think, yeah.
What Maybe inflation-wise, like Mike Schmidt, I know in the 70s was making a lot, but still wasn't a million. But, you know, inflation-wise, it probably
Reggie
was
and
equivalent.
Son, yeah, late 70s.
Reggie Jackson.
I think the last time we went down to watch them play was like maybe in 84, 83, 84, when they were still in Palm Springs. And it still felt pretty, pretty accessible. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I kind of got busy, you know, when my son was born and life started taking over. And I still paid attention to what was going on, yeah. You know, stats wise and just who was winning and that such. But I didn't, you know, we didn't do the Palm Springs thing in the spring break, but I would still try to catch games when I could. I think I've been to 16 different parks and maybe six or seven aren't there anymore.
Wow.
But I rode my bicycle across the U.S. in 96. And so I saw a game at Wrigley and saw a game at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh. And I would just do that in different places, you know, wherever I could during those years.
What was the impetus to the riding your bike across the country?
I don't know. I'd always wanted to do it. And I was in this period. I'm a good manifester. I was in this period of about ready to start to run my family business. And I did that for like 11 years, but I had this gap. And so I was chatting with a guy I worked with in Northern California. And he told me about this bike ride he did 10 years before. It was a fundraiser. I said, really? And so then I researched it and I signed up. And there was about 22 of us. And we went from Seattle to DC. And there was another group that went from Portland to DC and another one from San Francisco to DC. And we all raised money along the way for grassroots projects that we encountered along the way. And so since it was the 10th year it had been going on, it was called Bike Aid. We knew where we were going every day. Like sometimes there were little tiny, tiny towns and they'd have potlucks for us. We'd throw our bags down in a home or at a church floor in a high school gymnasium. Some of the times we camped. Other times we, what did we do? We stayed in like an abbey with monks in North Dakota. We stayed on a Native American Indian reservation in Montana. And so once a week we would stay someplace 2 days and do a community service project as well. So just had this amazing experience of America, big and small. I mean, we went through Chicago, Pittsburgh, Minneapolis, and some other places, but went through Yellowstone, really got to see a lot and a lot of different people.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
When my friend and I were finishing up Peace Corps, we were planning on walking from El Salvador to New York.
Oh my gosh.
And we got a publicist and everything. And then, what was that? That was probably 2002 when the war was breaking up. And so everything kind of fell apart and it might've been a good move not to do that in terms of what we would have been walking through. But, yeah, I definitely understand that, urge to just get out there and explore and
see what happens. That's amazing. I always wanted to walk the Oregon Trail too. I mean, it won't happen, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And I haven't read the journals of Lewis and Clark by candlelight since I figured they wrote it by candlelight. I mean, I can get pretty nerdy.
Getting in there.
I'm definitely getting in there.
Yeah. I mean, where was, I'm trying to think of the Bastards of Baseball. That was that
Portland?
Portland.
Yeah. That's a great documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't really aware of them at that time. But yeah, that was a fascinating story.
Yeah. I mean, so were these trips, the baseball trips, were they mostly you and your dad, like family?
Some of them were, yes, like up to Seattle. The ones to Palm Springs were just, it was during my spring break. And so we'd all just drive 1,200 miles. I don't know how my parents did it with three small kids, but yeah, that was those were family experiences.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever see the field in Iowa, the Field of Dreams field?
Yes, I actually lived in Iowa for 1 year. And so
really?
I made the trek to Dyersville.
Yeah.
Dyersville, yes.
Okay.
And my brother and I went and it was fun. And there was hardly anybody there when we were there. This would have been like probably 91. So just after the movie came out.
Oh,
And
wow.
they had balls and bats there, and you could just go and play a little bit. I remember my brother hit one into the corner. That was kind of cool.
That is cool. Yeah. I'm always surprised that apparently like it's still pretty low key.
That's good.
Yeah, like they haven't turned it into anything, but
They built that other stadium right next to it, which is, do you remember seeing that game last year, or was it last year? But I don't know. I've always just been curious and fascinated. And so my dad and I even went to Tiger Stadium the last year. I think it was around 99 or 2000, because I wanted to see that before they tore it down. That was interesting. Very interesting.
Do you get a reaction when you watch the movie Field of Dreams?
Oh yeah, absolutely. At the end, you want to have a catch? He's like, oh. Yeah,
Yeah, and
absolutely. Huh?
is your father still alive?
He is. He
Yeah.
is. He's 83 now.
Okay. All right. And is that something that you talk about? Is like baseball? I mean, what kind of, I know baseball for a lot of people and fathers and sons, like that's the connecting point. Was that true for you?
Sports is our connecting point, and he was a huge golfer, and so he taught me at a very young age, and that was our family business. And
All
so
right.
golf was probably the way that we bonded the most, but definitely through sports. I mean, I've been really lucky. We would go to Portland Trailblazer games early on, and I remember my dad split some season tickets. It wasn't very expensive to go then because they weren't very good, but he got season tickets with three other people in 76, 77. And so we had like maybe eight regular season games a year. And so I'd go to maybe four or five, and my mom would go to the other ones. And that was the year they went to the playoffs and won it all with Bill Walton. And during the playoffs, we took turns with the people that he shared the tickets with. And our game, our turn fell on game six when they beat the 76ers. So I was at that game as
Wow.
a 10-year-old. When Bill Walton and the rest of the crew beat Dr. J and Earl Dawkins and Lloyd Free and George McGinnis. And it was so freaking exciting as a 10-year-old, because I was just a huge Blazer fan. I wanted to be a Blazer when I grew up. And so I've had a lot of really amazing sports memories with him.
Wow. And did you ever play baseball?
I played, all the sports growing up as a kid, T-ball and or Little League and Y basketball and stuff. I played basketball for 1 year in high school, and I played baseball for 1 year in high school. I was a really good golfer in there at the same time, so I ended up doing golf my junior and senior year, and so we got second in state my senior year. But I still loved baseball so much. I found out about a men's over 30 league, and so I played 3 years in my 30s. Wood bat league, and that was a blast. I kind of tied things up. I felt like I left baseball kind of incomplete, you know what I mean, as far as playing and stuff. And so that was really neat.
Yeah, you were Doc Graham going back.
Yeah, it was Doc Graham, Moonlight Graham. Yeah. We played
Man.
double headers every Sunday, and I
So
was
that
much
was, I would
quicker than
imagine,
around.
so
What?
that was regular baseball overhand pitching.
Overhand pitching, there were some guys that played the minors. There was some competitive players, and there were some guys that were just not very good either. But I mean, it was really fun. And 2 years in a row, we went down to the Senior Baseball World Series in Phoenix, and got to play on some of the spring training fields and stuff. And I remember one of our games was at Grand Canyon University, and they have a huge green monster
Oh,
wall.
cool.
Yeah, that was neat. That was cool.
So, I mean, so right now you're like in terms of creative pursuits, still writing, you're acting, doing like
Acting.
screenplays as well.
Well, the acting's on hold. I moved away from LA a year ago. I'm in
Okay.
central Arizona now, about 20 miles west of Sedona. And it's been a nice place to kind of refill my cup. But I love to create positive content, whether it's a book, spoken word video, a short film, TEDx, you name it. And so currently, I just had a major surgery. I had open heart surgery 10 weeks ago. And so I'm just kind of.
Wow.
I know, and my heart's healthy. It's just I almost fainted at the gym in December. And after 8 days in the hospital during running all the heart tests, they found I had a little congenital hole and that my mitral valve was starting to leak. So they fixed them both.
Nice.
But right now I'm just basically in the process of working on a road trip memoir. I drove around the US for 6 months in 2021. And that's been a lot of fun. And I'm also, two of my books are kids' books, and I'm in the process of pitching one of them to become a cartoon series. So
oh,
cross
cool.
my fingers for that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
It's Stevie Alien.
I saw that on Amazon. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I'm doing a few things, but I'm also wide open. I feel like I'm going to be setting aside some stuff that I have been doing and to make room for new things. And I feel kind of like I'm in transition a little bit.
Well, that's such a great contrast to all of the other entertainment out there. I mean, that,
thanks.
Like, I feel like that's true for Field of Dreams too. And somebody I was recently talking to brought up Ted Lasso. You know, it's like these kind of anomalies that there, you know, there's conflict, but it's not, you have this enemy and you have these terrible things happening and everything's negative. And like, you can have positivity. You can have good things happening. You can have people supporting each other and it's still engaging. And so it's nice
yes.
to hear and see that's what you're working on too.
Thank you. I think people are starving for it. You know, it's just
yeah.
with the news, you know, I don't turn the news on, but if you turn the news on and then just everything that we kind of are, that comes at us is pretty heavy, and people want authenticity and vulnerability and positivity, and stuff that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, well, I watched your you have a couple short films on YouTube, The Search for Happiness. It's like it's a clear, simple message, but it's really nice to see, and
thank you.
I think people forget about that.
Yeah, we just need to get more of that out there and just to get people kind of like changing their mindset and really kind of just like, all right, it's not all about fear. You know, there's love and there's fear, and you gotta point it back the other way.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. I mean, you connected through Instagram, right?
Yeah.
And
Yeah, I love your
watching.
Page. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, what is it that hits for you?
Just facts, history, you know, learning new things. I'm always like wanting to take new information and you know, since you focus on baseball, it's really, I'm always interested in learning new stuff about that and stories that I had not been familiar with before, and just and you do a nice job.
Thank you. Well, I mean, that's what I'm working on now, trying to do an entire season on Field of Dreams from the very beginning, inception, to like how people are reacting now. And it's I mean, it's pretty cool. It's just like contacting people and like already like people who are open to talking from the film and, you know, making those connections. It's really fun.
That's awesome. You know, I actually, Salem, where I grew up, they don't really have one anymore. They had a minor league baseball team called the Volcanoes. And it was like a short season A team for the Giants, their very bottom team.
Yeah.
And a lot of their draft picks would go there initially and such. But they would have different promotions, and they had Ray Kinsella there. Or JP, what's his name again?
John, you're talking about the father? John
the
Kinsella?
The author.
Oh, W.P. Kinsella, Bill Kinsella.
W.P., yes.
Yeah.
He was there, and so I got a book signed, and I don't have it anymore.
Oh, really?
But he was there. Yeah, this is probably 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. You get around.
Well, that was my hometown.
Yeah, but I mean, wow, all your experiences and all your connections to sports and...
I've been lucky.
You're amazing.
One of my good buddies played Major League Baseball, and I met him in Salem. His name's Steve Decker. He played catcher for the Giants and the Rockies,
yeah.
Marlins, and his last team was the A's, Angels, excuse me. But he retired in 2000. His wife's from Salem. And so then he started working for the Giants, and he became, I think, his first gig the year after he retired as their hitting coach for the Volcanoes. And he and his family came into our golf center one time, and I started chatting, and I knew who he was, and we just kind of hit it off. And then we started playing golf a lot. And so he's just been a good friend through all the years. And but while he was working for the Giants in Salem, I mean, because he's pretty much done everything through the Giants. I mean, he was double A manager, triple A manager. He was a bench coach for 3 or 4 years for the Giants. And then he just retired this last year. But a lot of roving instructors would come through, guys that play like Willie McGee and Fred Stanley. And so I would play golf with them. And that, so that was really exciting for me.
I feel like Willie McGee, I remember it might have been on Instagram seeing something in terms of like
Cardinals.
Most hits, or like somebody in the 80s who was overlooked for certain offensive.
Well, he might even won an MVP award. I'm not sure, but he was really fast, and he was a good hitter.
Yeah.
Cardinals had really a lot of speed in those years with Vince Coleman and him, and I think Ozzie. And
yeah. Willie McGee, was he on the Royals too? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think he might. Well, he obviously, I think he was a Giant later on because he was working for the Giants when I met him.
I did my last episode was on catchers and how so many catchers become managers, and such a high percentage of managers are catchers. And you're just talking about Steve Decker, right? And he became a manager too, right? In all these different divisions. Yeah. That's really cool. So, I mean, how did you get into films? And was it mostly through creating that you started getting into the acting side?
No. So basically, I decided I wanted to leave the family business. I told my dad he was fine. This was in late 2007. We decided to sell it. And so I stayed an extra year while we went through the whole process of you know, finding the right buyer. And I was kind of just ready to hit the road and figure out what else I was supposed to do. I didn't know what I was going to do at that time. And I started feeling out of balance. I sat down one day and wrote down 5 things that I knew that would help keep me in balance. And it worked. And so my intuition just started saying, expand the list and write a book. It's like, what? I've never written before. But I did, and just kind of poured through me a very simple, kind of fun book on how to different ways to stay in life balance. And it's called Brian's List. And it was my first one. So after I did that, I didn't sell a lot of copies because I was shy and I didn't know how to market a book in 2008, but it won a couple of awards, which shocked me. And it just kind of got me, it just pointed me in a whole new direction. And I knew that if I wanted to share its message, I needed to overcome my fear of speaking. And so I had then moved from Salem to Reno, Nevada, because my son was just entering high school about 30 miles away from there in Northern California, and I wanted to be near him. And I just started, I did Toastmasters. I took a couple community college speech classes. I forced myself to do all these things. I hired someone to co-host an internet radio show with me way back in 2009.
Wow.
Made an interactive workshop based on my book, and I figured I was being smart by making it interactive so I wouldn't have to talk the whole time, but it ended up working out better that way. And I also took an acting class with no plans on acting. This is in Reno, Nevada. And after it was over, I had this dream about this street guitarist story. And when I woke up, I go, I have to write this down. And so then I met a young filmmaker there randomly, and I said, hey, I don't really know how to act. I've never made a short film, but I have a good idea. You want to do it with me? And he said, sure.
And you know how to play guitar.
Yes, I've dabbled with the guitar and up to that point. And so we made Guitar Man. It's like an 8.5-minute film. We made it on the streets of Reno over the course of 4 or 5 nights. And it just made me feel really alive. And it did well at film festivals and just woke me up to this whole other way of creating positive content other than writing. And somebody saw that and gave me the lead in their short film. And the woman who was in it, she's almost 90 now. She's been in a lot of stuff. They flew her up to Reno from LA. It was a sweet story, and it never got released, which I'm really bummed about. But I kept in touch with her. And after my son graduated, I felt like I was supposed to move to LA. And so she actually had a studio attached to her house. And so I rented that for the first 2.5 years I was there. And just dove in and took acting classes with people I recognized from TV. And it was terrifying because, I mean, I was a total greenhorn. But I started getting the hang of it, and I started booking some stuff. And it just that made me feel alive as well. But then I just kind of just opened up my world, and I wrote more books and did a TEDx and just created other, you know, things while I was there. And it was wonderful and great. And then I just, I went through, I went through prostate cancer 4 years ago, and that was interesting as well. But then there's blessings from all these hard things I've gone through. But I took a break when I got diagnosed, and that was right at the beginning of COVID. And so then I just, I left because everything was closed down. The industry was closed up. And that's when I drove around the U.S. for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that was really healing and good for me. And then I just felt like I didn't want to be in L.A. anymore. I feel like I'll go back and work occasionally, but it's getting harder to live there. And I'm more of an Oregon kind of relaxed guy, and it just kind of works on you after a while. And so then that's when I moved a year ago, and I've been in Central Arizona since. So I really didn't know I had all that stuff in me until I just kind of kept, like I did before with all those other things, just gently step into them and let them kind of just let the energy river flow and see where it led. And it led to all these other things.
Yeah. Well, it sounds,
yeah.
What, because what?
As I was gaining confidence.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like a flow. And, was there a lot of rejection and really false starts in those processes?
That's interesting. Not really. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of times I didn't book something. And early on for me, it was, I think it is for a lot of actors too. You just, the key to doing it and being in a good headspace is just to go do the audition, have fun with it, and let it go. And if you get called back, great. But if you, you know, you feel like all my eggs are in this basket and whatever, and then you're tightened up, you're not able to really just relax into the audition itself. And when I took that break and kind of got off the hamster wheel after my prostate cancer diagnosis, I realized it was wonderful. It gave me a chance just to relax, and it gave me permission to kind of say no. But I also realized that I was using a lot of what I was doing, and I'm proud of everything I've created, but I was using it as a validation tool for myself.
Yeah.
And so once I kind of didn't need to do that anymore, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've kind of shed that. It's just much, I'd be a lot better actor now if I was to go back and do it now. And just, you know what I mean? Just without all that extra worry and anxiety about getting a gig.
Well, how did you shed that? It was like, cause I know that's for me, that's something like I'm endlessly working on, and
I think we all are.
It's really hard to do. Right.
Well, I think it was a process, but once I became aware of it, that's the first step. And then I just, I put a lot of pressure on myself when I started writing those books, because four of them are in the self-improvement realm. I felt like I needed to be perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I put all this pressure, like I needed to show up for everybody a certain way. And I just needed to truthfully just be me.
Yeah.
But taking a step back and doing that RV trip kind of anonymously was wonderful, because it allowed me a chance to kind of begin the shedding and just kind of come back to the fun, nerdy, silly guy that I can be, and not this perfectionist. Yeah. And so that really helped the process. And then it's just been kind of a continuation, you know. Of course, you know, I want my stuff to get out there and, you know, share in a big way, because I feel like it's helpful and feel like I'm doing it for the right reasons. But I don't feel like I need that for my own self-worth anymore.
That's fantastic.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I'm a therapist as well. So
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. I'm a psychotherapist. I switched careers. So I was a English professor, and then I met my wife, who is a therapist, and little by little I started getting into it and discovering things, and eventually I'm like, I want people to see what I've seen and help people. And it's hard. It's really hard to change and to help people change, but it is fulfilling too. But
yeah, you know, real quick, I think it's no accident that my first book was on almost different ways to stay in life balance, because it really taught me the tools to that help when I go through difficult situations like my health experiences the last couple of years. You know, I know what I need to do to stay in balance and grounded, and it allows me just to kind of move through difficult situations a little easier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking to you too, it's helpful in terms of putting yourself out there, you know, because I'm doing this project and I'm like, oh, who can I reach out to? Can I ask this person something else? Can I ask for contact information? You know, and it's like, there's a part of me that closes up. It's like, well, I don't want to push it. I don't want to burden them. But then it's like, what's the problem? It's this, I control somebody else. I mean, and it's such an obvious thing. Everybody is responsible for their own reactions. And so they can say no if they don't want to. Listening to you, it's really helpful just to hear, you know, as you push yourself, as you have this confidence to try things, all that you can get.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, just if there's somebody you want to talk to in regards to the movie, just reach out to him. I think the guy who played the dad, I've seen him interviewed in different places before.
Well, I did interview him. Yeah.
Oh, he did. Okay, great. Because I was going to say, I Dwyer think he Brown. Likes to do that. Yeah. It kind of helps keep him in the limelight a little.
Yeah. I mean, he's fantastic. He was so nice, and talking to him, and ended up talking to Lawrence Kesenick, after that, who is the editor, he actually edited Dwyer's book, which is so good. If You Build It, and he has all these stories of people coming up to him afterward, and it's I mean, I cried a handful of times reading that.
That's amazing. You know, it would be so wild to have an acting gig like that where it just touches people well beyond the movie itself. You know, they want to come up and reach out to you. Like Band of Brothers is like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Those actors, it changed their lives.
Yeah, I can see that. That's one of my favorites. I probably watched that 3 times through at this point.
I got a Band of Brothers story if you want to hear it.
Yes.
So the real Don Mularkey lived in Salem, Oregon, and I had lunch with him a handful of times.
Before. Really?
Yes. His son-in-law I went to high school with, and once it came out, they all became rock stars. So I reached out to Dan and said, I'd love to have lunch with Don. Would he be open to that? He said, sure. He loves to talk to people and stuff. And so he was a really lovely man, and his mind was very sharp. And you could tell that he would still tear up when he told stories, but he wanted to do it. I think it was very healing for him.
Yeah. Wow. Did you see the character and like, oh yeah, that's do you know if the actors like hung out with them at all to?
I think they, I don't know how much they did, but I think, you know, they met them maybe during when it was released and such, you know, a couple different times. And a lot of the soldiers or, you know, gentlemen who were there, part of Easy Company, they went back to Europe for some of the different anniversaries or celebrations and stuff. And I think some of the actors would go too. So I think some of them developed a nice friendship.
Oh, that's funny. It's like once you mentioned that, it like slipped my mind, and then it's like, oh yeah, it's one of those shows. It's like West Wing. I love the West Wing, and it's like I rewatch that before I watch anything new, over and over again. And Band of Brothers and Field of Dreams. These shows that just touch people and accomplish so much. And I was talking to Lawrence Kesenick. He edited Dwyer's book, but he edited W.P. Kinsella's book, and he actually reached out to him initially because it was a short story. Shoeless Joe was a short story, 20 pages, and Lawrence, he's like, I think this is a really good story, and this was just based on a blurb, and I would love to work with you to turn this into a novel.
Wow.
And Lawrence was like, he's like, I thought like a ton of agents and editors would have been reaching out to him and nobody had. So he reached out to him, and then they worked on this and turned it into a novel. And yeah, Lawrence, he's like, part of me feels like, he's like, I don't know if this is too much, but like, that I was born to be part of the project or to like kind of push this into the world. And it's
absolutely,
it's amazing to hear that, because it's like, on one hand, it's like, oh, it's only a film, it's only a book. But on the other hand, it's like it affected so many people, like millions and millions of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's like, I'm getting excited putting this together. And it's a bit daunting too, in terms of how I'm going to structure this, how I'm going to put it together and, you know, make it as good as it can be without putting so much pressure on myself that it then interrupts the creative process, you know?
Yeah, that's always the, well, just know that, just have fun with it. You know what I mean? Let it,
yeah,
curiosity guide you, have fun with it, and just trust that it will be what it's supposed to be. And that's what I try to remind myself. It's not always easy.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's the reminders. It's like getting in a place where I can have the reminder come up too, which is really,
yeah,
important.
No, we all need to be reminded. Oh my gosh. I mean, but people will really enjoy it. And is it, how many years has it been now? Like 35 almost? 25. Okay.
20. No. 35. Yeah. 35
80s,
years.
Right?
1989.
Wow.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so a lot of the people who worked on this are actually dead also, which is, you know, it's like, I'm looking up people. It's like, wow, are you still alive? And it's so interesting to think about. Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, the reason I started this podcast in the first place, because I have a book coming out, and I got an agent for this book about a female knuckleball pitcher who makes it into the major leagues. And so that's going through production process right now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I've been writing for a long time. It's nice. Like, W.B. Kinsella was in his 40s. When he probably 43 when he wrote the novel. So there's time.
Never too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. You know, I've never really, the only fiction works I've done are the kid stories. That's a whole different ball game. You know, that would just, like, to write an actual novel would feel very intimidating to me. But I'm really good at all the other stuff I do. You know what I mean? I just feel like I'm a conduit, but I suppose you're kind of that way as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never really worked on nonfiction. I mean, the podcast and this stuff is nonfiction, but fiction always became easier. But I mean, what are you thinking if this kid series is turned into a show? Like, you'd be working on the series then?
Well, I've probably not.
Just like selling the,
yes, I helped my rights. My producer buddy in LA, we put together 10 episodes. We wrote, we're putting the first two episodes we're animating, so they can kind of see that. They can see another 8 episodes, you know what I mean? And then we have a huge Bible put together with the characters and everything. So that's basically what will be pitched. And then, you know, there's a lot of different ways it can go. Sometimes somebody will pick it up and then they'll do the rest. You know, other times somebody will pick it up, give us the money to do it. Uh-huh. With all the other stuff I'm doing, I don't necessarily want to be involved with that, if that makes sense. Get a small percentage, you know, from just the initial being involved in what have you. But because just all the other stuff I'm doing, it was fun to put that together. It was new for me, but I'm glad I did it. And I have another book too that we'd like to do the same thing for, and we can kind of intertwine them a little bit. So we've introduced the other character in episode 10 of this one. And so who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what have you found, like, in terms of accessibility? Is it the networking and being in LA that really gets it done? Because it's like, I've written screenplays, done well in contests, but then, like, there always seem to be dead ends, and it's always like, are these actually real? Is this a scam? Is this an avenue toward actually making something?
That's so interesting. Congratulations on the screenplays too. I mean, I've never really done that. I mean, I did the two short films, but those, I don't know. It's like they're screenplays, but they're not screenplays. It's hard to explain.
For the short films?
Yeah, that I did. The first one is kind of almost, people almost think it's like a documentary or in there, you know,
The
but
Guitar Man. Yeah. I mean, that feels like it feels like authentic, like you're just recording what's happening, although I'm sure that's not the case.
Well, a lot of the people I used were actually on the street.
Okay.
A couple of people were not. The comedian was a friend of mine, John, and some other people that I used to do some of the things. But I really did find real folks that were on the street, you know, and had stories to share. But I like if I was to like say, hey, you're supposed to write a screenplay right now, and it's like I wouldn't really even know the formula. I think I just kind of intuitively knew how to do the other ones. You know what I mean? It's hard to explain.
Well, it's also different if you're doing the directing and acting too, and you can think of it and put it all together, then it doesn't have to be straight from the script as much.
True, true. Yeah. But to answer your question, I mean, it does help to know people, obviously. And, you know, luckily I met some good folks while I was out there. And I wouldn't say by any means that I'm like, you know, have a lot of ins, but I mean, I know some folks who know how to get things done, and maybe know a few other folks, and you know, you gotta always still get, you still gotta do good work. There's a great Steve Martin quote says, you know, just do good work and they can't ignore you. You know what I mean? And that's for the most part true, I believe. You know, you still kind of gotta try to get it out there and have it be seen. But it does. It's an interesting thing. I mean, it does help to know some folks for sure. And yeah. Oh, but the screenplay stuff, I mean, I think most of those are legit. I mean, there's book contests too, you know, they're just money makers basically for the people that are putting them on. However, for the folks that do win or whatever, I've been really lucky. It does help, you know, it just makes people look a little closer.
I don't think I'll ever move to LA, but
I don't have a desire to go there now either. You know,
I mean, how is it? Where are you at in Arizona?
I'm in a little tiny town called Clarkdale, which is 20 miles west of Sedona. And there's just, I love history. There's a lot of history here. There's an old mining town that's 4 miles away, that's a mile high, that has a lot of cool history. And it's a lot of fun to go up and walk around and play in. And there's just, you know, Prescott's an hour away and Flagstaff's an hour away. And I don't know, just it's been a lot of good, interesting, cool people here that I've met.
And
And
climate's pretty good.
yeah, we're at 3,500 feet. We actually probably had the best weather in the United States last winter. I mean, we never really got any snow. It gets cold here, but it's a dry cold, so that's better than a wet cold. And they got snow up in Jerome. It's 1,500 feet higher, and Sedona got a little bit of snow, but we kind of just missed it. So it was pretty nice.
How about
It's
drought?
sunny most of the time. Pardon?
Are there any other drought issues there?
Not right here, because Flagstaff is a, you know, we're kind of below it, and you know, they get, they're at 7,000 feet. They get a ton of snow. There's some mountains there, and so there's a lot of like blow every year, and it gets hot here. It's already getting hot. It was like 97, 95 yesterday. We'll have stretches where it'll be like 105. They always say we're like 10 degrees less than Phoenix. But
It's,
yeah,
it sounds it sounds pretty nice. Like
it
I could
is.
do without, and I could do without the winter, even though I'm in Arlington right near DC, and it's not really bad. But I don't want it at all.
No, I don't either. And so it was nice not having any snow. I can deal with the cold, but yeah, it's pretty darn nice here. Yeah.
I can't think of anything else that I wanted to ask you. So
We covered a lot. Now, this has been a lot of fun.
thanks for meeting up, and it was fun, and yeah, I look forward to seeing what else you're working on. You were doing a podcast
Yes,
that's altered.
it's been on hold for a little bit, just as I've been kind of healing and stuff, but it's called the Creative Spark, and it's a lot of fun. I chat with creative, interesting folks, I even had a sports ESPN sports anchor on, former heavyweight boxing champion who's now an actor and a writer, other authors, singers, painters, just
Yeah.
it's kind of a, yeah, it's just, it's, I love stories. I love hearing other, I love reading biographies, just kind of, what people went through. And I find stories inspiring and interesting.
Well, I just wanted to talk to you because, I find your story interesting and, the baseball connection in terms of what I would do with this. It's likely to be a part of it. Of the new season in terms of
Please,
your
yeah.
baseball experience with your father and but that won't be coming for a while, but I'll let you know when that's happening.
Please do. No, and I'll be happy to share it in my networks. I mean, that'd be fun to share this whole thing. Just if people want to do a separate thing with it or whatever, and just it's awesome. This has been a great chat.
Great. Okay. All right, Brian. Well, thanks a lot and enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. It was a pleasure meeting you and chatting with you.
Okay.
See you, Ben.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson and all that is going on in his Creative Spark world, as well as this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. We love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.